our friend Yonat Moyes is going to be giving his presentation on the subject of a new stage in comparative theology, the mystical appropriation of Swami Abhishektananda.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yes, as you said, the title of this essay is a bit, it sounds a bit pretentious.
And, I didn't say that.
No, the title sounds, but I say that. No, the first part of this title is fine. I think Abhishekananda did, in fact, reach the new stage in comparative theology. The second one, it's a bit dodgy. The mystical appropriation of Swami Abhishekananda, I'm not sure if this is the right term. First of all, I'd like to dedicate this presentation to Keshava Dasi, wife and friend and inspiration of the director Shaunakada Dasi. She is a person who looked over this paper and she gave some comments, both in terms of grammar and also in content.
Oh, that's great.
So she's been involved in this paper a bit, so that's why I wanted to make that clear. And thank you for recording that, actually. Secondly, you probably know who was Abhishekananda. My paper is actually refers to it goes into the area of interreligious dialogue. It's not that scholarly like yours, and goes in comparative theology. And I believe that Abhishekananda needs to be more known, especially in England. I know that Bede Griffiths is more known than Abhishekananda, and I found Abhishekananda went farther than any other spiritual that went to India. In a way, my essay is good. It fits well in this session because you spoke about Vivekananda as a scholar, a Hindu who went into the West to explain Hinduism. But my paper is about a Christian who went in India to explain Hinduism to the Hindu themselves. So this is very... you will see why I'm saying that. In short, the Abhishekananda biography goes like that. He was born, he's a Frenchman from Brittany. He was born in 1910 in Saint-Brieuc. His real name is Henri Lossau. Etymologically, his surname designates actually a British lineages, a British descendant, so he must have a British roots. And at the age of 19, he joins a big Benedictine monastery in Brittany called St. Anne de Kergonan. And after 14 years of reflection in that monastery, he starts to contemplate going to India. In 1934, he starts to feel the call for a radical contemplative life, which he preferred to be in India. And he contemplated that for 14 years, negotiating his travel to India. And finally, in 1948, he reaches Sri Lanka on the 15th of August in India. So it's a man who went through several stages. He's a Purusha of the Rig Veda 1090. A guy, I mean, in a way, he's a person who went through all four stages, ashramas of Hinduism, and you are going to see why I say that. He was a man on a journey all the time, and she should not be criticized or condemned by the church for having done God knows what heresy or something like that. For example, Murray Rogers, one of his Abhishekananda's closest friends, wrote in 2003 about his friend's theology, Abhishekananda, that his theology, it was always moving on, and his understanding was in a continuous transitional process. Indeed, when a manuscript was sent to the publisher, Rogers remembers, Abhishekananda would say, "Mari, I have posted that manuscript, but is it still true? Nothing is static, at least a list of all my experience." So Abhishekananda always thought about his reflections, writings in the diary he left, for example, that his mystical insights are simple hypotheses. He says, and he draws the attention, that theologian who by chance may read these pages should please regard all these statements as only working hypotheses. And I believe that this is how he should be understood and not judged very easily. On the other hand, what he did is nothing but just faith-seeking understanding, like Francis Clooney puts it, following a phrase by Anselm of Canterbury. He was the one who said faith-seeking understanding. And it's actually, Abhishana, it's de facto comparative theologian because he applied this method. There are in history of the interreligious dialogue and comparative religion probably three stages. One is mission, the second one is enculturation, and the third one is Abhishekananda's stage. I want to look at the first stage, which is mission. That has roots in the Bible, for example, and I probably in the Vatican you can see the first documents of religious studies or studies about other religions, a systematic study of another religion other than Christianity. And it also rooted in the mission, Christian mission, who begins with Matthew 28:19, when Christ says, go and teach all the nations and so on. But this mission has been understood, has been taken always ad literam, in the sense that people, missionaries, thought that they should actually convert people. But as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 1-17, mission is not necessarily conversion. Mm. It's preach the gospel, nothing more. So, but what is mission after all? If it's not conversion, baptism, what is? It's probably witnessing, going into a place like Abhishekananda did, and trying to live that culture, that theology, Advaitic theology, Vedantic theology, and try to witness in that way. Abhishekananda, when he went to India, he went with this purpose, actually, to do mission, to convert people. But finally, after that, he overcame, he transcended this stage, because he said in a letter to Sister Marie Therese, I'm not a missionary. For me, the Indo-Christian mystic way of life is an end in itself, not a means. And also, in another discussion with Raimundo Panikkara, Abhishekananda says, again, denies the utility or the usefulness of conversion. And he says about conversion, people, Abhishekananda says, are converted. They receive an initiation, a diksha. They become Christian, Muslim, Sufi, Vedantin. But all these are superimposed forms, whereas the essential thing is to strip oneself of all that is superfluously added to recover one's proper form that was lost. And here goes into the Advaitic spirituality of the consciousness of I am, on which he reflected a lot. So again, he transcended this stage of mission, and no wonder that actually he has not received criticism from nationalists like Ram Svarup and Sita Ram Goel, people who criticized Bill Griffiths, for example, for his missionary work there. But not on our Abhishekananda. These people like Ram Svarup and Rita Sita Goel are people who founded Abhishekananda Society, which functioned until 2008. The next stage in the history of interreligious dialogue was enculturation. And Professor Clooney says that he still is a keen, an enthusiast promoter of this kind of, interreligious dialogue, because he says that prayer or liturgy, a comparative religion is deeply rooted in prayer or liturgy. And if you hear Professor Clooney speaking about interreligious dialogue, it's a very slight chance not to mention about Roberto de Nobili, a Jesuit like himself. But again, looking at this stage, Abhishekananda was not convinced at all. Although he tried to apply this stage after when he went to with Jules Monchanan, another Frenchman, Jesuit, to India, he tried to settle a monastery at Shantivanam Ashram, which is by the Chaveri river, and he created a Hindu-Christian form of worship. But he was not convinced. He was not convinced by that. And he will not be convinced by similar method that the Second Vatican Council tried to modernize the worship and so on. Why was not convinced about this new form of worship, so of changes in worship, is because for him worship was actually something that springs out from a spiritual experience. It was not just to create something artificially, but it needs to be moved by the Holy Spirit. He says in a letter to Père Le Marier, dated 24th January 69, there is little realization that the liturgical renewal springs out of spiritual renewal. And in another part, in Guru and Disciple, a book he published, he's been published after his death, he says, external accommodation of the borrowing of a few Indian elements from the spheres of art and folklore come nowhere near. The catalyzing process must reach the inner center of the heart. So again, enculturation was not a sufficient stage that satisfied Abhishektananda, and he went farther and farther to find the meeting point between Christian faith and Hinduism, not to the purpose of converting Hindus. And then he started learning Sanskrit, he started reading Upanishads in Sanskrit, and he came inevitably in contact with his neighbor Ramana Maharshi, whom he visited 1 year before his death, and he's been very moved, and from then on he started to read and study Advaita Vedanta. Now, what I said, from what I read, I read a bit of his diary, and I found that actually the similarity between Advaiting experience and his Christian faith has Abhishekananda found it in the idea of the mind of Christ. On the one hand, Advaita stresses the realization of oneness of Atman with Brahman, a realization in which one could overcome the opposites, such as likes and dislikes, pleasure and pain, merits and demerits, birth and death, the dvandvas, as he calls them. And on the other hand, he remembered that actually in the letters of St. Paul, Paul speaks about the consciousness of Christ. There is a passage in 1 Corinthians 2:16 when Paul says, refers to the mindset of Christ. And also in Exodus, the book of Exodus, the name of God, which is I Am, Exodus 3:14. Again, so there is this Exodus passages which defines the name of God in the phrase I Am, and in the Paul's letter where there are many several passages which shows that actually Christ shows the unique identity between him and the Father. For example, Abba Father, the cry Abba Father of which Paul speaks in Galatians 4 and to 6 and Romans 8 to 15. And he reflected on that, the mind of Christ, as a mind that anyone involved in the interreligious dialogue should have. And that idea of the mind of Christ fitted very well with the Advaitin identity of the Advaita, the Advaita identity between Atman and Brahman. This is where we speculate and try to read about this. There are also some problems in his way of expressing this analogy. For example, having appropriate Advaitic experience, Abhijananda's Christological theology focuses on the realization of the I Am, of Christ consciousness. In 1973, 2 months before his death, Abhijananda wrote to Mary Rogers that the kingdom is the discovery of the I Am. In a way, his theology, his discovery was a bit reductionist, because he reduced everything to the consciousness of I Am, which for him had an Advaitin resonance, but also a Christian one. Okay, if for him that was an appeasement of the conflicts between Advaitin theology and Christian theology, it was again not a satisfactory stage. He said that actually it is not in the mind that the meeting point happens, but is actually in the heart. So for him, the second stage of Abhijananda looks, on the one hand, at the mind of Christ, Advaitin Atman Brahman identity, and Paul's mind of Christ theology. And on the other hand, his stage of comparative theology refers to what he called the cave of the heart symbol. He chose this symbol and he started to explain it. If in the mind that conflict of opposites appeased, it sorted out, actually it's not in the mind that the encounter between religions happens, but in the heart. And this is a symbol which helped him to understand the oneness of his Advaitic Christological theology, which is both present, the cave of the heart is both present in the Upanishads and the Bible. In the Gospel, the cave is the place where Christ was born and resurrected. It is a sacred room where Christ advises us to pray, according to Matthew 6 and 6. Here it's Lawrence Freeman, probably you have heard about him, speculates a lot about this spiritual approach to Christ's teaching, contemplative approach. The cave of the heart is also the deep place in which a deep understanding is revealed. Deep calls the deep at the roar of your waterfalls, as the psalmist says. And also the cave of the heart are the guhas, the caves of Arunachala, where Abhijananda used to go quite often, and where he claimed to have having received the awakening. So it is exactly that idea that constitutes what I claim to be a new stage in comparative theology. Advaitin theology in comparison with the mind of Christ that shows the identity, the oneness, despite of the opposite. And on the other hand, the meeting point, the heart, which is a symbol that does not carry necessarily a sentimentalist connotation. The cave of the heart is rather a geographical place, an India, which anyone can reach. And it's by that, by listening deeply to the other spirituality, Advaitin, and practicing it, that one can reach this kind of depthness in the heart caves. And this stage, I believe, it's what I call the mystical appropriation, a mystical stage that my paper points, and can help all, not only the interreligious dialogue, but if his stage refers to appeasement of conflicts, that can have wider application in social, political or religious conflicts. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah. All right, you don't need to to have questions. You can have comments too.
Anyone else want to start first? I don't want to hold the.
Thank you. Yeah, I just wondered about your phrase, the mind of Christ. As I believe in many Indic texts, the mind of God, or the nature of absolute reality, and our relationship between it is often quite well, well explicated, even in revealed texts such as the Upanishads. But it struck me that the primary source of Christian revelation has comparatively few references to such a mystical topic, really.
To the mind of Christ.
Yes, obviously it has references to his speech, but I just wondered how we build up our conception of the mind of Christ, or is it the Gospel of John, for example? Where do we look to understand this conception?
Yeah, there are very few, there are not that many passages on the mind of Christ, but they are there, and I would say quite striking and fundamental. And I can give you a list now. Paul, 1 Corinthians 2:16. 1 Corinthians 2:16. Galatians 4:6. And Philippians 2:6 or 2:5. So there are few.
So it's all in the Pauline. Right?
Yeah, in Paulinian. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and the definition of God of I am in Exodus 3:14, but this is not really. So there are 3 or 4 or 5 passages in the. I'm telling you that because I looked over these expressions recently, willing to write an article on ritual and the mind of Christ, and I found that the mind. What does it mean to have the mind of Christ? Of course, it's not the nous. Divine news of Christ, the divine. We don't have access to the divine mind of Christ. But I think since the incarnation took place, we also are able to have that mindset of Christ, the Christic mindset, in which mindset one can overcome the contradictions, the schisms, hatred, and all these kind of. Sectarian tendency.
I just had a very general question, but in terms of this new stage, is it a stage that's perhaps the sort of process he's gone through sounds very profound and demanding. Is it asking too much? How much scope is there, do you really think, for having an impact on the dialogue between religions if it really requires us to go through that process? How much is he really even? I think I'm sure many would see him as. How much can you call him a Christian anymore?
Indeed. That's why I said.
That's very threatening. I would imagine for those who are rooted in,
I think his approach is deeply psychological on the one hand, deeply anthropological. And by that, if there are several paradigms in the religious dialogue, either you are theocentric, God-centric, or Christocentric. Mm-hmm. If you are God, you don't involve Christ in that. Theocentric, and here all those religions who believe in a God are involved. Mm-hmm. Christocentric dialogue, all those religions who believe in Christ. And also another level of an interreligious dialogue, it's anthropocentric. Mm. All those religions who believe in humanity, who believe in human. And I think that it goes into that direction. Okay, sure. And that's why some people hardly can call him a Christian.
Sure.
And it's a real crazy person. He went to a very, very far point.
Yeah.
Not everyone, this is not the vocation of everyone, but I wanted to discuss about him because he's very little known in academia. And better known is Bill Griffiths.
Yeah.
Yes, but Bill Griffiths did not go to that stage like him. I think he's a phenomenon. He went to the farthest point possible.
Do you think Bede Griffiths kind of it remained more proselytizing in nature, or something? There was a canvassing kind of.
Yeah, as you have noticed, the three stages.
Yeah.
I think Bede Griffiths did not go beyond inculturation stage.
Mm.
So he is on that level.
Okay.
Inculturation, Roberto de Nobili. The Catholic approach.
Frank Clooney?
Exactly.
No, he's not really.
Exactly. So Bede Griffiths was on that stage. And that's why I claimed that this Abhishekananda must have gone beyond that stage.
Yeah.
But that stage needs to be explained.
Yeah.
And it's what I've tried to do.
Mm.
Yes.
Something I found very interesting is this connection with Ramana Maharshi. Could really be brought out in probably is this sense of the I am something he really emphasized.
Yeah.
It's kind of the imminence of, you know, sort of more Abrahamic language, the imminence of God present. So you kind of have that across Christian mystical traditions.
Yeah, interesting.
But I wonder, what comes to mind is the sort of difference between the path and where the path leads. In other words, this tension between, you know, when he's talking about stripping away superimpositions, I mean, this is classical kind of Advaita Vedantic thing. You know, at the same, you know, if someone on a path has a identity as on that path, but if that path is understood to lead to ultimate reality, does that then... do you take that identity? Do you take the path identity to the ultimate destination? You know, in other words, when you are in the ultimate salvific understanding, whatever it is in the different traditions, it's obviously understood differently. Do you keep your sense of identity? In other words, are you a Christian when you attain salvation or liberation or the highest good? So if you're not a Christian anymore, you're not a Hindu anymore from the vantage point of the highest reality or the highest good, then when you speak from that, if you are at some kind of mystical understanding, right, and if you're speaking from the vantage point, which is without any vantage point actually, of the ultimate reality, then you would not have an identity of, you know, or would you? I mean, this is an interesting tension, you know. Would you be a Christian then? Because... Or would you be beyond all the accretions of self, body, and identity as I'm a Hindu, I'm a Buddhist, I'm a Muslim?
Mm.
Would that be there anymore? And if it's no longer there anymore, that's an interesting way in which you have an esoteric meeting of religions.
Mm.
And maybe something like Thrift Schwan, sort of this perennialist, or traditionalist kind of discourse about interreligious dialogue might speak to this.
Yeah. We also need to explain what is identity.
Okay.
What is identity? Does it change? Can you have more than one identity?
Right.
It's possible to have.
I mean, one distinction is like personhood versus consciousness, right? Or soul, or self, or Atman. So personhood is constantly changing. It's relational. It's narrativized. Self or Atman is power which animates, allows for that to be.
Yeah.
Is there some correlation with that in Christian theology?
Yeah, exactly. Prophets. So there is room for more.
But there could be interesting tension. You know, that tension is interesting.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, I mean, like, you're kind of going towards the sort of John Hick direction in what you were saying there, the really real, and then the sort of phenomenal like...
That map,
yeah.
Kind of a Hick map.
Yeah.
But then sort of it's what I'm getting from, you know, what you're saying, maybe something in the more like Schwan and Nasser, these traditionalists where they talk about a transcendent unity of religion. In other words, there's no unity on the path, which is that's where personhood and identity as a practitioner of a certain religion exists. But in the transcendent goal, then there, of course, is unity. So then what vantage point do you speak from?
Mm-hmm.
If you're speaking from that vantage point, then a correlation could easily, then you could see where him and Ramana Maharshi would kind of
But the thing is, can you speak anymore from that vantage point? It's because as soon as you speak, you're bringing into the world, into language, into name and form, and all of that. So maybe just silence, a kind of.
Right.
So it's interesting you mentioned Schwann, who's perhaps grown a little bit forgotten today.
Yeah.
Do you feel he has much to offer serious academic dialogue about the concept of truth in these religions, or is he sort of hopelessly colonialist now, or indeed too tied to a slightly political tradition, isn't he?
I think he has something to offer. Yeah, I think he does. He's quite rigorous. I think the sort of, within his worldview, he's operating as this kind of he's a metaphysician, basically. You know, so within that context, in this kind of dealing with these sort of inward interiority, sort of esoteric paths, I think there's something in it to be said for what he's arguing, whether or not that has applicability outside of very select kind of pick and choose kind of version of religious history. You can have your Ibn al-Arabi, and I'll take Shankara, and I'll take Meister Eckhart. I mean, but there's something there, to be.
Sorry, and I had a question about Frank Clooney, because I've delved into his work a little bit, and I find it actually quite inspiring at
times.
Is this
the man at Harvard?
Exactly. Yeah, Harvard. Yeah,
yeah,
Harvard.
Yeah, yeah, I've read his books.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You see, he was here for a while. He was the
was
the academic director here for about two years or so.
Oh,
he was
really?
Yeah, yeah.
I
don't know. Maybe even longer than that. I'm not entirely sure. But from what you're saying, it's like he's stuck at a kind of intellectual level that's not really getting to the heart of the issue.
He likes Bichon's approach. He is not just an intellectual, and he's. He says that, as I said here, for him, comparative theology is also rooted in prayer and liturgy, in a spiritual engagement to another religion. So I think he is very open-minded to Abhishekananda's approach. Not just to Roberto de Nobilis or Bill Griffiths. I think it's more than just an intellectual. My feeling is Clooney is into a deeper understanding of another religion.
I mean, it seems that he's kind of, because he's very, it's like he's trying to move beyond the theology of religions, which is very kind of, taking a stand outside of things where you've almost already made up your mind a priori. His approach is almost allowing for a more genuine encounter with the other and the possibility for transformation in that encounter.
And
that's kind of heading toward the direction that you're hinting at here.
I think so. I think Professor Clooney's Clooney's strategy is outsider insider always. So he's not just an outsider, but both ways.
What is the position on proselytizing and conversion with Abhishekananda? I mean, is he preaching? I mean, cause this becomes very, this could be very paradoxical for me now.
Because
I read it as being, this kind of transcendent.
He went there with this purpose.
Yeah.
The diary shows that his first letters shows that actually he went there with Jules Monchanan also to witness and to make an ashram open.
What is witness? Sorry.
To witness to this is a rather French term, témoigner, showing.
To show.
To bear witness.
For
to
me,
Christ.
Exactly. Witnessing for me has a twofold meaning: contemplation. Witnessing face to face, and witnessing, showing, preaching, and they went with this purpose to open an ashram, to be open to all people, Hindu people. Tamil Nadu is the most Hindu part of India, in a way. I mean, it's very Hindu. You know better, but that's why they said that they went to Tamil Nadu specifically because that is the heart of in a way, the beautiful temples, Hindu, and so on. You know, I mean, India is very big and very, it's
very
gross. No, sorry, my English is horrible. And I have. You see what happens if you pose too many questions.
Yeah, maybe we should wrap up now. You think?
Yeah. Thank you very much.
That was great.
Thanks so much,
for both of you. It was really wonderful. Wonderful session. Great.
Stop.
Oh yeah. Sure.